From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on July 24th when Congressman Paul Ryan released his plan to alleviate poverty. Democrats and progressives were skeptical leading up to that release. For years, they had seen Paul Ryan operate on a traditionally conservative theme, tax cuts for top earners to spur more growth and more hiring. For conservatives, Ryan has been a stalwart of their values. So when July 24th came around, a lot of people thought it'd be more of that, more of the same. That's not exactly what Paul Ryan is offering. His anti-poverty plan is called Expanding Opportunity in America. And it has surprised many progressives, at least on some levels. It includes the idea that incarceration exacerbates inequality, so we should find ways to have fewer people incarcerated for shorter sentences. Ryan agreed with President Obama about the need to expand the earned income tax credit. Now, he disagrees with Democrats on how some of these ideas should be paid for, and that's where good old-fashioned political compromising could come in. His critics say his plan is too paternalistic. We'll get into why some of them are saying that. But too often in the media, we obsess about the horse race. We focus on how a proposal could affect a politician's chances for re-election instead of actually analyzing how their policy proposal would work. So today, we're digging into the policy with a panel that is, we're staying away from politics. We're talking about policy. Later this month, we're going to look at some of what Senator Elizabeth Warren has been proposing. Today, some of what Congressman Paul Ryan is proposing. Joining me for the hour is Kent Gardner, economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Kent, nice to see you back here.
Thanks, Evan. Nice to be here.
Jane Lynch is the retired director of the Department of Social Services for Ontario County and has had plenty of experience in the work on welfare reform and other issues. Nice to see you, Jane.
Thank you.
And Ed Doherty is here. Ed's the author of the recently published report on poverty for the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Ed, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, let's see if we can actually find some places to agree, but disagreeing is fine, by the way. I do want to hit one point here before we even get going. I want to play a soundbite from Robert Reich, an economist and the former Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He has been a consistent critic of Paul Ryan. Here's what Robert Reich said last week on ABC when he saw the new Paul Ryan anti-poverty plan.
I was frankly very impressed. Paul Ryan, who has been cutting programs for the poor left and right, or at least trying to do that for several years now, awarding tax breaks to the rich, suddenly he has had a conversion of some sort, and he is now coming out with a plan that is actually a very interesting plan. Not only does it expand the earned income tax credit, which is the most important anti-poverty policy we have now in the federal government, he extends it, he expands it. He provides some guidance to the states in terms of actually helping people go forward. It is not exactly a block grant. There are no cuts to poverty programs. This is something that is very new and different from the Republican Party, and I think it deserves a careful look by Democrats.
All right, Kent Gardner, Reich hits on one of your sweet spots. You've been saying for a long time that the earned income tax credit is a good idea. Why?
Earned income tax credit is an efficient way to improve people's income using the tax system as the vehicle to do that. I mean, the earned income tax credit is often set up against the minimum wage. So on the one hand, if we increase the minimum wage, we're messing with the labor market in a significant way. A big increase to the minimum wage messes with the labor market in a very big way. The EITC, on the other hand, you get to the end of the year and someone who's been working uses the tax system and says, you know, this is how much I earned, and we make up the difference. So we're not distorting the labor market. We're encouraging people to go out and work, and we're still subsidizing their income, which is the goal of the whole thing in the first place.
Yeah, in this plan, Ryan seems to be agreeing with President Obama on how to expand it, essentially doubling some of the, as I understand, some of the parameters for who would benefit and how. Are some of the policy ideas you saw regarding EITC, are these solid policy ideas in this plan?
Yeah, I think they're excellent policy ideas. And I think that a lot of, you know, as you heard from Reich, I think people left and right, everyone agrees that the EITC is a really good vehicle. It's also relatively efficient in terms of its administration. This is something we can do through the tax system, which we already have in place.
If everybody agrees, what are we still waiting for with this?
Well, it does cost money. And, you know, certainly we've got a Republican majority in the House that is saying if you want to increase spending on something A, you've got to reduce spending on something B. Mm-hmm. So while I think everyone would agree that if you're going to improve that the EITC, expanding the EITC is a good idea, I think you're going to have a tough time figuring out what it is you're going to cut. So that's probably where that's getting into politics, not policy. From a policy perspective, I think everybody agrees that the EITC is a really good place to be.
Okay. So on the politics side, if they can compromise and agree, Democrats and Republicans, on how to fund it, they seem to agree on many sides. I mean, not everybody agrees, but a lot of people agree that it's a good idea. So maybe we'll see that component happen.
And we'd hope that seeing Paul Ryan stand up and say this is a really great idea and we should do it will help. You know, he still retains a little bit of power in the House, we hope.
You would think.
Yeah.
You would think. Now, we're going to spend a lot of this hour looking at a portion, because we can't get to everything in 1 hour in this plan. We're going to spend a lot of the hour looking at a portion of the plan known as opportunity grants, and I think that's a significant part of it. Before we do that, I want to hit another part of the plan that is getting praise in many progressive circles, and that has to do with prison sentencing. And let me just read a couple of quotes, because one of the things Paul Ryan is saying in his plan, and you don't often hear conservatives say this, is that inequality can be exacerbated by incarceration, that we have a lot of people incarcerated and many people for nonviolent offenses. They have long prison sentences. They have a hard time finding work when they get out. There are kinds of issues related to that. Here's Elizabeth Nolan Brown writing under a headline, Paul Ryan's Poverty Plan, Why Are Liberals Ignoring the Criminal Justice Reform Aspect? She writes, a huge part of what helps keep people poor is our draconian criminal justice system. The link between poverty and over-aggressive incarceration in the U.S. is undeniable. Obviously, criminal justice reform alone won't end poverty, but it could help make a serious dent. Let's give credit where credit is due in this case to Paul Ryan for recognizing that in this plan. And here's Matt O'Brien writing in The Washington Post. He writes, it's not just that we're sending people to jail who we probably shouldn't. It's that we're sending them to jail for so long. This leaves them all but unemployable when they do get out, which can push them back into crime. Ryan agrees, and Democrats should too. Does our panel agree that this is a significant step for Paul Ryan and for conservatives to acknowledge this? And maybe, Ed, you want to jump in there?
Well, certainly it is a somewhat a significant change of course for people on the right. There's no question that it has a huge impact. John Clofus out at RIT has estimated that there's nearly 3,000 people per year entering the community from the criminal justice system in some form or another.
In Western New York?
Right here in Rochester,
yeah,
in the
okay.
city of Rochester.
In the city of Rochester.
That's correct. And so the point being not just that these are folks who don't have skills, that don't have employment options and contribute significantly to the poverty reality, but that the whole expectation of people who are not succeeding in school, not getting opportunities in school, that somehow they're going to just not have these opportunities. The criminal justice system becomes an option, not a good one, but an option. And we go way overboard. And I think the overly aggressive part of that description is the one that makes the most sense. I think we're seeing it with some of the changes in the mandatory drug laws. Clearly, we incarcerate lots of people, and we didn't reduce drugs. It's a more complicated problem than just threatening incarceration. So I think it's an excellent area for us to look at as a society and figure out a better way. We clearly incarcerate far more people than any other society.
Jane Lynch, retired director of the Department of Social Services for Ontario County. What do you think on this angle?
I agree. I did work in Albany for several years and had the opportunity to walk down the special housing unit, which is solitary confinement, and speak with individuals who were incarcerated in the SHU for years and years and years. I'd like to take a look at it from a fiscal perspective for children. From a fiscal perspective for children, a lot of these people who are incarcerated are parents who, if they had employment, that they would be contributing to a household, a two-income household, hopefully, or even through child support, therefore reducing potentially the poverty for kids. The downside is, do we have enough jobs? So it's hard enough for us to get employed those individuals who have a lot going for them, let alone those who step out of prison and don't have a lot going for them.
Kent Gardner, when I reached out to you for feedback on the Paul Ryan plan, you called this part of the plan refreshing. Why?
Well, it's just so incredibly wasteful for society. As an economist, we look at the resources of society as what makes the economy tick, and traditionally economists talk about land, labor, and capital. And labor comes in lots of different forms. And when you take a promising young person and you throw them in prison for, often these drug offenses are really minor. And let's face it, then they come out and they've got this blight on their record. We've just lost access to this viable young person who could be contributing to society. And of course, Ed and Jane have pointed out, someone leaves prison and if they don't have the skills, if we kind of truncated their career, they can actually return to a life of real crime, not just a petty drug offense, but going into things that are actually destructive for society.
Yeah.
So there's just so many reasons not to use the criminal justice system as liberally as we have.
And prison can turn ostensible criminals into real criminals. And that's the last thing that you want. So when it comes to Paul Ryan's anti-poverty plan, you've got the earned income tax credit. A lot of agreement that that's a good idea. You figure out how to pay for it. Maybe that can get done. You've got this notion that over-incarceration is really costing us. It's hurting us. It's exacerbating poverty and inequality, Kent. I mean, is that a fair statement?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yeah, no question about that.
Okay. So poverty and inequality exacerbated by over-incarceration. That's another prong. So maybe prison sentencing reform will happen. And then we're going to get to the opportunity grants in a second. If you want to join the program with questions or comments, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Right here in Rochester, it's still 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Our panel is talking about the policy, not the politics, but the policy of Paul Ryan's new anti-poverty plan. We have Kent Gardner with the Center for Governmental Research, Ed Doherty, who wrote the recently published report on poverty for the Rochester Area Community Foundation, and Jane Lynch, who worked as the director of the Department of Social Services for Ontario County, among others. Let's get our first call. This is Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon. While certain parts of the Ryan plan may be progressive in some aspects, we can't forget that the trajectory of the Republican Party is to turn the United States back to the way it was 100 years ago, with no minimum wage laws, with weak unions, no maximum hour laws, no Medicare, no Social Security. They want to turn the country back to the way it was during the robber baron era, because people like Mr. Ryan live in an Ayn Rand fantasy land.
Well, Don, let me jump in and say I do appreciate the call, and there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, let's look at Paul Ryan's body of work. This is so out of character for his proposals that do we trust it? That's fine. I'm trying to say that's sort of for another show. We're going to talk about Elizabeth Warren's proposals, and we're going to look at the policy and not the politics. I'm trying to stay outside the politics, and I know there's sort of some inextricable link there. We're not trying to get anybody to like Paul Ryan or dislike Paul Ryan or like Elizabeth Warren or dislike Elizabeth Warren. We're trying to look at the actual function of the policy that has been proposed in this case, and that's what I'm going to try to stick to in this hour. So if you want, again, you want to join the program, I see more calls coming in. We'll take more of your calls. We're happy to do that. Or you can join the conversation on Twitter as well, at Evan Dawson. Opportunity grants. Let me start. I'll start with Jane Lynch on this, because, Jane, we're talking about – well, actually, unfortunately, Kent's going to be the economist who has to do some definitional stuff for us. And so, Kent, opportunity grants, this part of the Paul Ryan plan – how does it differ with the current system? What's sort of an easy way to describe what this would entail?
Yeah, I think the system we have right now, and Jane knows the system intimately, so many of the programs are siloed. So you have certain funds that can go for one purpose for housing, another set of funds that can go for food, another set of funds that can go for job training, child care, and these various siloed programs all have their eligibility rules, and sometimes they're very different eligibility rules. Medicaid has different eligibility rules from another program, and so we end up with this very, very complex system of determining who's eligible for what, and we spend a lot of money, frankly, figuring out whether people are eligible for various programs, and sometimes someone's eligible for one program, not for another, and sometimes what they need is the other thing, not the thing that they're actually eligible for.
They're eligible for food stamps. They really need help somewhere else. Or they're eligible help for somewhere else. They really need food stamps. Or
yeah. So Ryan hasn't really defined the details here, but he said maybe we should be block granting this, and the notion of a block grant to the states suggests that the states perhaps have an ability to innovate in a way that the federal government, working under the confines of congressional laws, maybe does not. So perhaps the states can come up with different ways, and perhaps we should be putting these funds together into a single pool so that we can use them more creatively and more flexibly. And his notion behind that is that there should be he's putting a lot of stock in increased case management, so we will give more discretion to people to have more authority to say, this is really what you need. So we're going to, find funds to, instead of just, taking money from each of these different programs, we're going to give you the money to address your specific need. With that, I should pass to Jane.
Well, and this is her. And again, it does sound like this is kind of states as a laboratory of democracy kind of a thing.
Yeah, that's part of it, certainly. So it's both pieces. It's the notion that that we shouldn't be so prescriptive in how we hand out support for people in need. But then secondly, that perhaps if we're not going to be prescriptive, somebody has to make up some rules and somebody has to administer the programs. And why don't we let the states, try to figure that out?
All right, Jane. So in theory and in practice, and they may be two different things, but let me start with your general take on the notion of what Kent just described with these opportunity grants.
I think the notion is very laudable. From a client's perspective, there was a fellow during welfare reform of 98, David Elwood, who called welfare and getting on all these programs genocide by exhaustion. So we take a person who wants to work and needs to work, and we have them running in and out of appointments to get child support, to get food stamps, to get public assistance, to get Medicaid, to get housing. They all have different systems. So what we're in essence doing is making a full-time job of applying for benefits and keeping benefits as opposed to focusing on applying for work and keeping work. So from a conceptual point of view, I think it's a laudable goal. We have these different funding streams, as I always view them, as not by design but by lack of design. For instance, SNAP or food stamps was and is under the Department of Agriculture. So it never aligned with public assistance. So they were all mishmashed together in a way, and different parts of the federal government made different rules and different laws about how they'd be implemented. So ideally, from a consumer's perspective, how we could have them focus on living their life and improving their lot is to not have them have to apply and participate in so many different programs, because no one can get involved in all the programs. That said, our history with block grants is declining money. So, who knows what would happen if the economy changes or doesn't change, but every block grant that I've looked at, I just brought a few things from, this is from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, but talks about since 2001, the reduction in block grants, Home Investment Partnership Program down 58% since 2001. Community Development Block Grant down 49% since 2001. Training and Employment Services down 42% since 2001. Maternal and Child Health Care Block Grant down 34%. So, unfortunately, the concept, in my opinion, is great, but show me the money.
In fairness, Jane, just quickly, it isn't unique to the character of block grants. I mean, Congress voted to fund these programs at lower levels, and they could fund all the individual programs at lower levels as well.
Right.
And perhaps there is something about the way the block grant is structured that makes it easier for Congress to spend less on this big pool than to spend less on 12 puddles that used to be that made up the pool.
Okay, but we can agree that if this model that Paul Ryan is proposing is brought into practice,
number one, we have to be cognizant of the fact that at least Jane is saying block grants appear to be vulnerable to easy cuts. And if that were to happen in this case, well, we're going to talk in a moment about why it may be underfunded to begin with because of some of the challenges in implementation. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But the bottom line is you'd be concerned that this would be too easy a target to reduce. And in 5 years, we're going, well, this isn't working. Okay. So that's some of Jane's concerns. Ed, what do you think about opportunity grants?
Well, just to pick up on James' point briefly, it's easy to be opposed to entitlements. It's hard to say what entitlements you are going to reduce. So that's sort of the political reality of moving to block grants. You don't have to make that argument anymore. You simply can say, well, you know, we need to make cuts and we're going to cut. We really need to understand poverty better than we do. After spending many, many months researching poverty in Rochester and coming up with all manner of statistical information about it, I came away with the biggest reality being that I don't really understand the people and the realities that of people's lives that are behind all those numbers. And we need to recognize that it's complex. There are no silver bullets out there. And I think we've done a lot of things poorly over the years. I think that we have, for lack of information, for lack of knowledge of what the realities are of people's lives, designed programs that wouldn't necessarily be effective. Best example is the approach I think that we take to workforce development and economic development. They're two very different things, and if we're going to help people to be able to take jobs, we have to make sure that we create those jobs specifically or have those jobs available. Before we could do any of that, though, we need to know why are there such barriers to people getting out of poverty? What are the realities that people's lives are all about? For example, in the city of Rochester, this is the entire city, nearly 39% of the population is not in the workforce. 39% of the adult population. That's not unemployed people. That is people who are not seeking
don't have jobs, not looking for jobs.
Not looking for jobs. Now, that includes seniors. That includes people who have retired. That includes a large number of people. But it's higher than the national average. It's a significant number. And I'm not sure we know what it is that we're attempting to deal with. So learning more, engaging the poor in that process, learning from the poor, that's something that I think we might want to try to do a little bit more of.
Well, and by the way, if you're on the phone and waiting, we will be getting to you, and I'm glad to see the phones lighting up, but we're going to be taking calls in just a moment. I wanted to go through some of the big prongs before we got to more phone calls. Part of what Democrats and progressives have been criticizing in the Paul Ryan plan is that they feel it is too paternalistic, and that's because it includes, and I probably am not going to describe this perfectly, but kind of a provision in which folks in poverty are offered some help putting kind of get out of poverty plans together, kind of a model of a plan to work, a plan to save, a plan to this and that. And some progressives have criticized that as too paternalistic. Rihan Salam, who writes for Slate.com, who is very conservative, says it is absolutely paternalistic and it should be done. But what's interesting about that is here's some contrast. 2 months ago, a new study came out, and it came from, I want to make sure I get the, oh, where did this come from? Vox.com is quoting this World Bank study. And what they followed was, let me read this. This is from Vox.com in June. As solutions to global poverty go, just give poor people money is actually pretty rock solid. A recent randomized trial found that Kenyans who received no strings attached, just cash, from the charity Give Directly, built more assets, bought more goods, were less hungry, and were doing better and were all around happier than those who were block granted money for specific purposes. But voters and politicians generally prefer giving people specific goods like housing or food or health care rather than plain old cash for fear that the cash might get misused by unscrupulous poor people. Kent, that may be a whole other topic, but we're looking at efficiency. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I've seen those studies, and it is really intriguing, and I think that the work that was done in Kenya is fascinating, and it says a lot about how we handle our aid programs, particularly our foreign aid programs. I think there is some relevance, but I think it's also easy, I think, to overgeneralize from that conclusion. Mm-hmm. The other problem I think we have is that I think taxpayers have a real hard time with that, and it's actually the criticism I have.
Moral hazard?
Yeah, and it's taxpayers' money, and it's one of the problems I think that they actually, in terms of that very specific study, I think one of the intriguing things about that study is that, I mean, we're going far afield. We could go a long way on this one. In terms of foreign aid, it's astonishing just how much foreign aid money goes to child sponsorship programs, for example. And child sponsorship is a very, very popular way to give money. And I think the notion of, trying to – if you're a charity and trying to raise money to simply hand people a check each month, you're going to find that a very difficult thing to do. You're going to have a really hard time getting people to sign on. And I think that the taxpayers behave a lot the same way. So I think taxpayers are going to have a hard time saying, you know, we're just going to – you know, hand out cash. We're going to get rid of the other problem. I think is that there are some things that we put in buckets just because we're not willing to, for example, let people die on the streets because they have an illness. We say if somebody walks into a hospital emergency department, the hospital has to care for them because we're not willing to let people. So suppose someone, you know, gets a cash grant, they are out of money at the end of the month and they can't pay their hospital bill. We're not willing to say, tough luck, buddy. We say the same thing about food and housing, that we're not willing to let someone not be housed just because they've gone through the cash grant we gave them. We're not willing to say that, you know, I'm sorry you don't have any cash left. That's your problem. You're not going to eat this week. So there are some limitations to the notion that we could just be converting everything to cash grants.
Go ahead, Jane.
I was around. I started my career in 1977 taking welfare applications in Monroe County. And this was when public policy was such that it was cheaper just to give out public assistance. And I would say to people who applied, tell me why you can't work. Once welfare reform came about in 98, the premise was, and I am a pragmatist who believes in this, is work first. I believe, based on years of experience with individuals in poverty, that and individuals anywhere, that everyone needs a reason in the morning to get up and to contribute to society. We were blamed in the 60s of just handing over welfare and becoming the welfare father. We paid the rent. We paid everything. And I think we've come quite a ways since that. And welfare reform in 98 really focused around shifting from supporting people who aren't working to shifting to support people who are cyclically working. My view of public assistance, and I think many don't share this, but the statistics show that it is a very fluid number. When you say a certain percent of people aren't working, yeah, that's in any one month. If you say there's, you know, this many people on public assistance, it's different people every month. So there's this cycle. Sometimes TANF to me is like unemployment UIB for the poor, people who don't have enough quarters. So my focus on this plan is employment related.
If the two extremes are this World Bank study saying, hey, just give poor people cash, don't sort of earmark it for specific things, that's more efficient. And then the other extreme is a plan in which you get either food stamps or medical assistance or child help or child care very specifically, along with you must meet these requirements and get a plan where someone is helping you draw up a life plan and all this stuff. If that's the paternalistic extreme, then maybe the Paul Ryan plan is somewhere in the middle where, yes, you get help drawing up sort of a plan, but states have more discretion on how to create the grants and to create the flow of that money. Is that somewhere possibly true? It's somewhere – I mean, it's closer to the paternalistic side and less to the cash for the poor side, but it's somewhere in the middle.
Well, I think our history is certainly in that area. I mean, we're always juggling. We're going back and forth in terms of programs, in terms of, you know, how many restrictions we place on eligibility, you know, how eligibility is determined, what kind of penalties there are for people who receive benefits that aren't eligible. You know, so it's this yin-yang that we go through all the time because there's no perfect solution to the problem. It's a really difficult thing to do, I think, and do well.
And we're going to talk about putting it into practice. So here's what we're going to do. We're talking about the Paul Ryan plan, his anti-poverty plan called Expanding Opportunity in America. What does it entail? How would it work in practice? Our panel is helping us with that. Kent Gardner is an economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Ed Doherty is the author of the recently published report on poverty for the Rochester Area Community Foundation. Jane Lynch is the retired director of the Department of Social Services for Ontario County. Your phone calls are coming next, and we're also going to talk about really from theory to practice on opportunity grants, implementations, what it means in the field, all of those things with the panel who have taken the politics out of it as best we can. This is Connections on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson on the next. I was supposed to read that live because I didn't tape anything. And you know why? Because tomorrow is Healthy Friday and I actually don't know what we're doing. But that's only because I've been digging so much into the Paul Ryan plan that my head was buried for the morning. So tomorrow, take my word for it, Elise Orlando and Michelle Faust, who's covering questions on the Affordable Care Act. They do a fabulous job and you will be educated if you join us from 12 to 2 tomorrow or your money back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Appreciate you joining us here as we do our best to kind of go through the Paul Ryan plan with this excellent panel this afternoon. And let's get some calls here now. This is Milton in Penfield. Milt, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for receiving my call. I appreciate your programs. A couple of points to explain. I worked in urban renewal. I worked in model cities. I worked in community action. And I worked in welfare reform for 40 years, and I've studied and worked on the political and the ideological side and the funding side. So my comments will be brief. The process, the system for distribution, qualification, and distribution of federal tax dollars with some model of assistance from state governments mandated as a part of local share, there's nothing new about it. The point is, what is the ideology of your pursuit and how do you intend to compensate for everything at once? How do you start the engine going in the car? How do you make sure you got gas? How do you make sure you know where you're going? And how do you make sure that the alternators go to work? Whether it's block grants or opportunity grants or state grants, it's usually a primary amount, not recently, but it's usually a primary amount of federal dollars going for special assistance to special needs. And the problem with the discussion of Mr. Ryan's, actually it's a five-year-old budget that he's recapped a couple of times, the budget opportunities or pathways to American democracy, whatever it was called,
the roadmap, yeah.
You have to balance every characteristic of need in order to satisfy some characteristics of need, because when you evaluate, if you don't have enough emphasis on unwed pregnant mothers, you just don't have the money, or three states say they don't want to participate in the money, your whole national characteristic has been destroyed. And that's how we get into the kind of conditions we're now in the House of Representatives, where nobody wants to do anything because they got their own personal prejudices. The fact is that we've worked closely and know what categorical grants will do, and we work closely and we know what block grants often won't do. If the nation has a problem with poverty, and we do, because we're the most impoverished nation in the world of the developed world, We have the highest levels of poverty and the lowest levels of specified solutions to that poverty. We have to take on housing. We have to take on social services. We have to take on health care. We have to take on education. And we have to do it in a uniform manner based upon local need. We tried to do that with urban renewal. We tried to do that with model cities. And then Nixon said, forget all of that. We're going to give block grants to everybody based upon their politics. And that's what we're still doing, only now we're fighting for fewer and fewer dollars and less categorical definition or evaluation.
Okay, well, Milton, you give us
all
a
right,
lot
I'm
to think about. Oh, yeah, thanks for the call. I appreciate that, Milton. I'd like our panel. Anybody want to weigh in first here, Ed?
Well, it's a, philosophical question,
yes.
Categorical versus block grants, and I think that the ship has sailed on the old concepts of categorical grants for the most part. The issue is certainly one of adequacy, and that brings me to a point that we seldom talk about here, which is we like to think we're going to solve the problem, whatever the problem is, in this case, poverty. But as a practical matter, I think we all know, no matter what program policies we pursue, no matter how much resources we put in, it's not going to solve the problem. The problem's too big. So the question we have to ask from a policy standpoint is where should the next dollar go? You know, what's the most productive way that we can improve the situation versus where it is now. Now, expanding the earned income tax credit, that seems like a good place, and maybe that's what we will wind up doing from all of this. I would like to see some experimentation done. I think that we don't do a lot of that in the area of welfare. For years, there were opportunities for states to get waivers and attempt to do some experimental things, and there was some interesting stuff done there, but I think we need to do a little bit more of that. It's got to be we need an even more creative approach than the question of categorical versus block grants.
Go ahead, Jane.
I wanted to respond to Milt's. What I agree with is saying that block grants do allow for special communities to deal with their own particular problems. I worked in the inner city of Rochester. When I went to Ontario County, a whole different set of things of people who were living pretty solo, pretty rural in Naples, in the outskirts of Naples, where there weren't programs and there weren't a lot of social service agencies. What I notice about the proposal that we're discussing today is he did look at a lot of urban poverty. So as soon as we think we have our finger somewhere, there's always that, oh, but we're missing this. So I think, again, we did talk about the flexibility of block grants. When I was in Ontario County, we did Wheels to Work because we didn't have the robust transportation system that this county has. So we were able to make different choices based on the needs of our population.
All right. Let's go down the line, grab another call here. This is Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, go ahead.
Hi. I realize you don't want to talk about politics, but it seems to me that one of the fundamental problems we have is how our democracy is broken. And I don't care who gets elected president, because I don't know that the president has the power that they used to have. Consider the fact that these children that came across the borders, Congress had to do this kind of strange vote so that they'd show they'd done something, but they really hadn't done anything. And in truth, the people that run the politics or used to run the politics no longer have the power. So we're no longer a democracy. So you can't fix a social problem unless society is involved in the problem. And in our politics, you don't get involved in the problem, you get involved in the financing. And that seems to me to be our major problem right now. We have the resources and knowledge to fix these problems, but we don't seem to have the society anymore that'll focus on them. and thanks for the show.
Yeah, thanks, Bernard. I think that may be a little bit of an oversimplification. We do have the resources, but and we may have the knowledge, but not everyone agrees on just how – it's not easy. It's not like it's a, you can go to the store shelf and spend $100,000 and this is the plan that solves it, and why don't we just go buy that plan and do it? I think that's part of why this discussion is taking place. On the notion of politics, let me explain it better. If I were to say that there were a plan in which the creator of the plan argues that incarceration in this country is exacerbating inequality, most people would assume that it comes from a progressive or a Democrat. That's been sort of a rallying cry on the left for a while, not so much on the right. The fact that in this plan, Paul Ryan is saying it, some of the criticism is some people on the left will immediately say, well, forget him. He doesn't really mean it or whatever. I'm just trying to say, what's he actually saying and proposing? That's all I'm saying, Bernard. You know, you don't have to like Paul Ryan or you know, whoever it is. That's all I'm saying in this case. So I want to get back to the notion of what happens to, say, for example, caseworkers, because they'd be big in this kind of a plan. And implementation, it's one thing to take this Paul Ryan plan, this anti-poverty plan. It's another to implement it. And there would be a lot of pressure on caseworkers. Can't you raise the point that some of the caseworkers are young, they're idealistic, but they're already dealing with a lot of work to begin with? This may give them more and more responsibility. Explain to me, and then we'll talk to Jane and Ed, because I think, what was your first concern when you saw this plan in terms of implementation?
Yeah, my context is my daughter is a social worker in Austin, Texas, and I hear a lot of stories from her. And one of the things that's clear about frontline social work, and she's 27, she's fairly new to the career, is that there's a tremendous amount of turnover. that's because the work is very difficult. There's a tremendous amount of turnover partly because there are, I think, often not enough social workers. It's not something that we want to spend a lot of money on. So we starve the system. We have a lot of young people who are cycling in and out of the jobs. It means that often they don't have the experience, they don't have the training they need to do the job as well as it needs to be done. So if we're going to assign a lot more responsibility to them, I think that we have an obligation to make sure that there is sufficient casework and that they're well enough trained to be able to do the job. The other point is that social workers, caseworkers are under a tremendous amount of pressure. They're under pressure both from the people that who pay their paychecks. They're also under pressure from clients. Clients have a variety of needs, and if the caseworker has the power to allocate funds in particular ways, they're going to be under a lot of pressure to spend the funds one way or the other, depending on, again, you know, which voice they're listening to.
Jane, you've seen it in the field for years in your background. What do you think about that?
I support caseworkers, and I have cautions. The reason I support caseworkers is I believe in Ruby Payne, those of you who are familiar with her work, talks about what people who don't have money value primarily as relationships. That's their primary currency. And a relationship with a caseworker is someone who's a cheerleader who can help things. Everybody, even I could use a secretary in my life who can say, here, this is what your businesses. The problem that I've seen with caseworkers and government is that we don't ask anyone to prioritize. So whenever I sat in a case conference about a client, someone would say, oh, she should go to parenting classes. Oh, she should do this. Oh, she should have nutrition. There was successful models that say, what's the one thing? What's the one thing your family has to do? Because I don't want someone coming in my life and telling me the 10 things that I know I have to do, but I need to work one at a time. So, and I do worry about going back to personal responsibility. So a caseworker really would have to promote personal responsibility. What I don't like about a case manager model is we have hundreds of case managers. And so in theory, if there was one, that would be great. But we have hospital case managers. We have school case managers. And my fear is that we will create this middle industry that will not encourage people to take their own personal responsibility for some of the issues that they have to deal with.
On Twitter, a woman goes by Ordinary Mama makes a point that I think is a fair one. You know, again, we've been trying to take politics out of the discussion, but she raises the point that there's a question on what is, you know, the systemic causes of poverty. And if there is disagreement with the creators of a plan like this, and Paul Ryan and Elizabeth Warren, for example, would probably disagree on the systemic causes of poverty, that sort of gives you a little bit of an insight into what the progressives have said is Paul Ryan's paternalistic view of what needs to be done. And Ordinary Mama says, you know, there's a moral judgment of how people live their lives. And, you know, Ed, does that complicate matters? I mean, do we have to understand the systemic causes of poverty? I don't know that everybody will agree on that, but...
Well, it'd be good to understand them. It certainly would be helpful if you want to establish policy. And,
yes.
And in addition, not only is it helpful to inform policy, if we don't have an understanding, then everybody's opinion can fly. You know, you can have an opinion. Paul Ryan can have an opinion. I can have an opinion. You can have an opinion. And nothing makes those opinions correct necessarily. So I think the more good information we have on those kinds of issues, good shared information, the better we're going to be. Now, there's certainly limits to that. I think this notion of caseworkers is it's a policy question because some people will be helped. Many people will not be helped by this. And so the question becomes, is this the place to invest the next dollars? Is this the best way? Or would it be to give people more income? I agree with the caller that government programs should not be about telling people how to run their lives, should not be about creating draconian incentives for people. It doesn't work anyway. But it's also not a productive idea. On the other hand, if caseworkers were a resource to individuals, if they were able to operate across silos, they could help individuals access health care coverage. We know that there are tremendous unmet health care needs out there, including mental health needs. And people don't have access to those kinds of resources. We think they do, but they don't. And so that may be a way in which this idea could be a productive piece of the solution. But it can only be a piece of it.
David in Rochester, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, David.
Yes, thank you. I'll be brief. Looking at the prison system, which was talked about in the Ryan plan by your speakers, looking at the front end is a good idea, but looking, you know, in terms of lessening penalties, but looking at the back end is very important. And a very controversial point, which I support actually, is college education for prison inmates, which is a proven entity that it reduces recidivism rate when those qualified for the program and earn their way through receive credits or a college education and leave, and they are employable. They do not return. That saves definitely cash on the other end of the area, which I think should be considered in plans like this. And that's really all I have to say.
Yeah, David, thank you. If you're just joining us, part of the Paul Ryan plan is an acknowledgement that over-incarceration in terms of the number of people incarcerated and the length of their sentences exacerbates inequality, unemployment, poverty, etc. That's sort of a big deal to hear someone in on the right make that point, and maybe we'll start to move towards an agreement there. Anybody in this room disagree on the notion of tuition for inmates? Is there a general agreement that – I know a lot of people on the right don't like it, but everything I've seen – and I'm always – I'm an evidence guy. I try not to be an ideologue. I say, what does the evidence say? And the evidence says if we're spending $60,000 plus per year on an inmate, and it would cost $2,500 to $5,000 to educate them – and I don't mean blanket. Again, we could do a whole other hour on this, and we've already done that. I think the evidence indicates that could work too, and I think that will be less controversial going forward. Ed?
Well, you know, we talked about trying to lessen the lost resources of people by reducing the amount of time people are incarcerated, reducing the types of situations where people are incarcerated. Now you're talking about, can we make incarceration productive? That's a whole nother area that is fascinating to delve into, and I'm certainly no expert in that area. I think that I would support the idea of college, being able to get a college degree while you're in prison. I think it's a productive use of the time that's there.
Especially if it reduces recidivism. Have you seen enough evidence, Kent Gardner, to tell you that you would support it?
I definitely support it. I mean, there's absolutely no question that if we can make an investment in the human capital that we're stuffing into prisons, it's going to pay off for us. It's not just going to pay off for the inmate. It's going to pay off for us as a society.
Right. One of the last words of the hour is going to go to Pete. Pete, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
You know, the poverty is a result of lack of funds, which is directly connected to the loss of decent, good, middle-class jobs, which were shipped out of the country with free trade. A couple of years ago, when the sequestration budget cuts were about to go into effect, Business Insider conducted a survey, and yes, they did the same thing you're talking about, taking the politics out of it. They wanted to find out which provisions the public approved of as opposed to the sequestration cuts. Interesting, they decided to pull on the provisions, not on the budget. But when they did pull, the final outcome was that even Republicans rejected the Ryan budget. The budget proposal that got a majority of Democrats, majority of independents, and even 47 Republicans was the Congressional Progressive Caucus's budget. And I would suggest that the people
That's okay, Pete.
National Priorities Project website.
Okay.
And what it does is it compares all the three different budget proposals. The progressive budget proposal would put people back to work. This idea that we continue to cut, cutting interferes with raising revenue, raising taxes. If people aren't working, they're not paying taxes. If people aren't working, they're not buying things. If people aren't buying things, there is no need for business to produce anything more because they can't sell what they already have on their shelves.
And Pete, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. Kent, real quick, let me ask the economist. He said free trade's been a big problem in terms of jobs. That's a large blanket statement that could spend a whole other hour. Quick take.
Only 1 hour?
I know.
Yeah, I think often we confuse conflate free trade with a lot of changes in the global economy that happened at the same time. On balance, I think most economists and on the left and the right would argue that free trade has been, on balance, good for us, given the alternative. And the problem is that we began moving towards a more of a free trade regime right after several decades when the United States really had the only game in town. So it's really very difficult, I think, to isolate.
Kent warned me we wouldn't even get through half what we wanted to with this. And you know, when I talked to Jane and Ed, look, this is our best effort to give you a glimpse at what the policy of the Paul Ryan Anti-Poverty Plan would bring. I think we've delved through a lot of material, and I think it was very productive. And if we aired it all, it's because the host could have done a little bit more to make sure we were on track. But I think we did a lot here. My thanks to Ed Doherty. Thank you for the time, Ed. Great to see you in studio. Kent Gardner, thank you very much for your expertise.
Thank you.
Jane Lynch, you look different in person than you do on television and the movies. That was the first thing she said to me when I called her yesterday. That was your joke, Jane.
That was my joke.
Thank you. Nice to see you. Have a great weekend. I'll see you guys Monday.